What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode. I am so close to the mic right now. I'm a mess. What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of American Daisies. I am Arjun.
I'm Akash.
And we are sitting here in the stunningly beautiful campus of University of California, Santa Barbara. This is the first of our West Coast road trip.
Yeah.
Of American Daisies. We're on the road, folks. And our first interview, we are really excited to sit down with this handsome young professor.
Rated very highly
on ratemyprofessor.com.
Also, they have a hotness meter. You're not doing too badly. We got a little merch next to your name.
That's exactly what I... entire life is based on that.
We're talking here with Samir Pandya. Did I say that right?
Yeah,
Pandya?
That's perfect.
Doctor.
Dr. Samir Pandya, right?
Yeah,
that's right.
I got one of those. Yeah.
You have a PhD, that's correct. And you're a professor, but you're also a writer. You've written a novel that we will talk about, The Blind Writer, and also, which is a collection of story stories and a novella.
Yep.
And right. You also used to write for ESPN, SI. So he's basically Akash and I am my hero.
He's a hero.
Let's start with the book. I'd love to talk about The Blind Writer. They are not what I was expecting in the stories.
Uh-huh.
There was a darkness to them that maybe this speaks more to me and what I expect out of South Asian writers. It unequivocally does speak more. But I was really stunned and very excited by, like, Mother was so interesting. The story about the mother and the spelling bee and just a really dark relationship between the mother and son and the ways that... and often true, like the ways that the child's life validates the mother and what that means for motherhood in South Asian American culture. Where did the origin of these stories come from for you?
For the stories in general?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll talk about mother as well. You know, first of all, thank you guys. This is perfect. Terrific. You know, I think the origin, I'm kind of interested in failure.
Mm.
And kind of what it means to fail and how, and I don't, I mean, what's interesting about you saying darkness, which is, I don't consider myself a dark person. I don't think most people I know.
You actually seem super positive and like upbeat.
Yeah. And that's what's so interesting, right? Because I wrote these stories, but there must be something, you know, that's... Well,
you said that you're interested in failure, and right before we started, you know, you were giving a little background and you were saying that you got your PhD because you were afraid of telling your family what you really wanted to do, which was right. Were you, to me, that indicates an environment where failure was not much of an option.
Yeah.
Is that accurate?
No, I mean, it's interesting. I don't want to put it on my family. They were very, very open, right? But I think it's a pretty convenient thing for me to say that I didn't at 22 say I'm going to be a writer by saying, you know, my family would not have approved of it. Because that's really not what my family is, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're not like, go do whatever you want. We don't care. We'll pay for it all. That's not going to happen either, right? And so I think it's a combination. There are certain expectations, explicit and implicit. But then there's also... we've talked about it. There's also fear, right? Which is at 22 to announce that you're going to do this while the rest of your friends are doing things that seem more productive, when the rest of your family is doing other productive things. It's a harder thing to do.
Yeah.
So now, 20 years after the fact, I think it's a combination of, like, I don't know what to trust, right? Was I scared? Were they scared? It's probably some combination of both, right? But I do think that, that's that kind of Indian South Asian thing, right? Which is
two questions actually, real quick. To speak to one Indian South Asian thing, there's a thing I've noticed with at least our parents' generation. They want us to depict positive things. They hate seeing Indians depicted negatively.
Yeah.
Your books we're not monsters, but they're dark. These people aren't likable people.
Yeah.
Does that cross your mind as you're writing this? You're kind of breaking this thing that we're ingrained with?
Yeah. You know, it's really interesting. So the first story I wrote in that book that got published as a book called Welcome Back, Mahesh. And it's about these two brothers, one of whom goes to jail. And I remember being at a family function of some kind of second cousins or something, and I was talking to one of the aunties, and she had this great line. I was sitting in the kitchen. She's like, I can deal with my kids taking drugs, getting into all sorts of trouble, but going to prison, that would break me, right? Wow. And I remember thinking about that. I'm like, why is the prison part the thing that would break you? Right? And why? Mm-hmm. And so I think less about kind of thinking about the darkness, but just I am just interested in these, you know, we tell stories to kind of exist, right? And, you know, mostly like fiction writers, you try to get to the stories that don't get told, right? And the stories that are kind of, you know, not present in certain kinds
of ways.
Here's
what's interesting, though. I'm sorry to keep going, but here's what's interesting is you wrote this about, I really like that story too, writing about an Indian kid who went to jail, but it wasn't an Indian kid who went to jail and then came out determined to make everything right and atone for this thing that he did. And like, it was one mistake and I'm going to be better. It was an Indian kid that like, his brother was like, you didn't seem to learn anything. You don't seem to feel any real guilt for what you did. And I guess the kid did, but it wasn't like, then at the end of the story, he's just kind of like, all right, yeah, I am this guy.
I think what I'm actually literally discovering this in this moment of how deeply ingrained the model minority is stuck. And even though I don't feel protestantly for myself, but yeah. I've placed it on everyone I meet because I think that I think that's why the story surprised me.
Yeah.
Because there isn't model minority in here. And what I guess that's what made them darker, because they're not dark. Like they're not, there's not murder. It's not gory or anything. They're very human.
Yeah.
And they're very flawed. These people are flawed. And I think that's what's was thrilling. And then, you know, we just got a chance to sit in your class, which we will get to talk with more about in a moment. But this is where the bleed happens. And where you seem to not, you want to futz with the model minority, it feels like, at least in these stories. Is that conscious or is that a conscious choice?
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting, so look, when I have my scholar hat on, I can say I'm messing with the model minority myth.
Right.
But when I take that hat off and I'm trying to produce stories.
Yeah.
I think what I'm trying to do is, you know, I'm doing an inventory of myself, right? Like saying, okay, what are these expectations, right? So there's a language for it. When I show up in class, I can use all this language, critical language for it, right?
Right.
But when I'm sitting down, I'm not thinking this story is going to be about the breaking up. Because anytime I think a story starts with an idea,
you're in trouble.
Deep shit, right? So then you become preachy as opposed to actually just producing the story of the people that have populated your lives. You know, stories, my stories, right? Like, you know, none of these characters are named Samir, but Samir is all over this book, you know?
This is part of another question. Actually, I'm going to be, if interest of full disclosure, I couldn't get my copy of the book until last night. Read half of it in one night. I thought it was a great book.
Yeah.
And the one that, I don't know, resonated with me, but there's this story called Housewarming.
Yeah.
Which is this guy, he seems to really like his life, and then he goes to this really beautiful house owned by another Indian guy with his wife, and just like this jealousy that pops up. And like, this is this thing I've been thinking about a lot recently, is like this like competitiveness within not just Indians, but like everybody, this kind of suburbia life. Can we just talk about that story and like Rohit, the guy who gets so jealous? I just want to talk about that story.
Yeah. So just as very briefly, this guy, this family, perfectly fine. They're well off, you know, go to this housewarming, and it's, you know, the house is five times or three times as large as his house, right? And so part of it was just, I am just interested in envy, right? It's because, shit, I feel envy all the time, right? Like that is a natural human emotion, right?
Yeah.
And I think that that there was just this moment where I think these are the South Asian lives I want to explore, right? Like that there is a way in which, like what does it mean when you, like what, when you've built these big houses, right? Yeah. And what does it mean if, you know, like how do you manage not having one of those houses? It sounds ridiculous, but it is, that is part of the issue.
Part of the human experience.
And that's what I'm noticing amongst, a lot of Indians have family friends that their parents just grew up together in our generation. And all these little envious things pop up that destroy friendships. And I've been looking at that from a distance, like what is that? That as we get older, these little things become so competitive and like throughout the course of the story gets so bitter and angry, and it's like that's a real thing I'm seeing as I get older amongst these families, and I've been noticing that recently, so this story resonated with me.
And you know, I will say that, you know, my favorite moment in that story, in this whatever, but I'll just say it, is I love that moment when he goes into this clean bathroom, pees all over the place,
right,
but then cleans it up, right? And so the anger is the peeing, but there's a way in which the cleaning up is him like backing away, right? Which is right. Like, okay, I want to be angry, but I can't be explicitly like, I hate all of this. I'm going to scream and leave this house kind right. of angry. So there's a way in which I think that was the moment I wanted to explore, which is how do you kind of have these moments of rage and how do you pull back those moments of rage at the right. same time?
Which speaks to the inner conflict of like, if we, you know, I'm stuck on this model minority thing because yeah. I'm confronting it in ways that I, you know, am my own prejudice that I'm wrapped around moments. But it's that it feels like it's that we're trained to be so good and like how to be so polite and what is the right way to be a guest and what is the right way to be right. Totally. I think that for me, one of the big shifts that I've experienced is, you know, the idea that for my compass is north was do the right thing, not do the right thing, but be right. You know, be perfect, perfection, all that sort of stuff. And I feel like that was ingrained by, you know, not only culturally, but also like just in my house. And it is feels very uniquely to that, like that kind of mentality that you would do something rageful, but then feel immediate regret and need to clean it up.
Yeah, no, that's exactly, there is, I mean, I think this is what, like, how is it that this stuff gets hardwired in us, right? Like, it's not as if, like, you know, everybody says, or like a lot of parents say, right? Like, be a good kid, do these things, right? Be responsible. But I guess the question is that are there certain, in our particular context, is there ways in which the weight of that demand, which is be a good kid, is heavier? Right? Weighs in a different kind of way. And I wanted to circle back to something that Akash had said in my class about his mom landing in Dallas and thinking that there was no racism, right? Like, my dad came here in the late 50s in California. And, you know, for the entire time he was alive, we never had an explicit conversation about race and racism, right? Like,
I still have it with my family.
Exactly. I mean, what is it? That silence there is so interesting, right? Which is, they're not, I mean, certainly he felt it, right? Certainly he experienced it. And I know he experienced it the older he got. But what I was interested in there was like, but what was this thing to not say anything about it, right? Right. Where, and I think that that's part of, I mean, I think in these stories, not just with race, but with everything, some of these characters are quietly beginning to have little explosions, right? They're like,
Okay, well, so that's going to bring me to two questions. So put a pin in the explosions, because that directly is to my second question. But I want to ask about these characters and the stories themselves, where they come from. Are they inspired by events or experiences you've had or that you've read about? And then I'm wondering, like, did you read about someone that went to jail, and then did you decide to make him South Asian? Do you know a lot of South Asians that have gone to jail? I'm curious about that, like, where the inspiration for the actual stories of these.
So I'll give you two examples. So with with the Mahesh story about the jail thing, right?
Yeah.
So I grew up, my father's father went to a British political prison in the 30s and kind of part of the independence movement.
My dad went to prison for some political thing, too.
And that story becomes this, like, family myth, right?
Yeah.
Not that it is false, but it becomes like, look, this guy went to prison for the good of a country, right? And so what it does is it attributes a certain kind of masculinity, a certain kind of morality, ethics around that act, right? I gave up my life, my work for these 6 months I was in.
Right.
What I was interested in was what happens 50 years later if the descendant of that child is selling liquor when he shouldn't be selling liquor.
Well, I mean, in that, you put this in the story. I remember this part, but it was also like, well, you can frame it, and it probably was, as going to jail for a political reason.
Yeah.
Going to jail for selling liquor, it's much harder to frame that in a way of like, he was rebelling against this thing to give us freedom.
Exactly.
He's just trying to get some 16-year-olds drunk.
Right. Exactly. So and make a little extra money to buy stereo equipment.
I'm like, well, I mean, that makes sense. Of course they're going to look at it differently.
Right. But I guess what I'm interested in here is what happens when you grow up with that myth of this is why he went versus you make these decisions that lands you in a completely opposite way. Right. And so that there are these moments. I mean, the spelling bee story several years ago, I was watching SportsCenter. And I don't know if you guys remember this kid, Akshay Buddhiga. And, you know, he got up on stage and he was about to spell a word, and his eyes went to the back of his head. He passed out, and then he got back up and spelled the word right.
I heard about this.
And so, you know, whatever, Scott Van Pelt or somebody was just like, oh, this is amazing. And I just kept looking at that, and what I was so amazed by it was like, what got that kid to get up? Right? Mm. If I passed out on national television, I'd just stay passed out, right? Yeah. I'd be like, get me a doctor. Something about this 12-year-old kid was like, I'm going to get up. I'm going to get back to the mic. I'm going to spell the word right, and then I'm going to go sit down.
Yeah.
And so what I was just interested in there was like, why? Right. And I didn't want to know the real reason why, right? Like, I didn't want to go find out who the guy was and what his family life was. I was just much more interested. And so it began with just that moment. But then, you know, so, we all have mother issues. So I kind of started dealing with the mom stuff, you know?
Okay. So this triggers.
Not me. I love you, Emma.
Yeah.
So this triggers the question that I had. And this is based, and I wrote it down because I took some notes during your class because it was so fun. Yeah. Okay. So in your class, which is, I don't know if it's interesting, but Asian American Studies, it's an Asian American Studies class.
Yep.
Yeah. So you were talking that the first part of the class was that before 1965 and the Immigration and Naturalization Act.
Wait,
right?
Are you getting a, can I ask one more book question? Is this a book
we'll
question?
Come back to it. No, come back to it. Shift from 1965, so that was before that was exclusion, uh-huh. right? And then post 65 was this shift to the model minority, right? And
making broad brush, that's totally
super,
right.
Super reductive way of Sweet. Talking about Perfect. This, right? I'm saying that those, so shift from exclusion, model minority. I feel like we're in a shift again.
Yeah.
And I feel like that shift is that we are no longer able to stay as silent. Because you were talking about the part of the model minority is to be the model minority is to be the silent minority, right? Yeah. That was something that that you had mentioned in class. These books, the characters you're talking about, explosions.
Yeah.
Would you agree that there is a shift happening now from the away from the model minority? I'm feeling a shift right now. I'm wondering, do you feel a shift within within Asian Americans at this point in time?
You know, I will not speak for the bigger group. I'll just, for me, absolutely.
Okay.
Right? Because it's claustrophobic. It closes you up, right? And so that there's got to be a moment where you're just like, enough. And I think that it is, you're seeing it in all sorts of different ways, right? You're seeing it part of what I try to do in this class is to say, look, let's look at a bunch of different examples where people are trying to break that stereotype down, right? For me personally, I am so sick of that as the thing that shapes, that narrative shapes how people look at you before they meet you, mm-hmm. right? That you're Indian, honestly, I've gotten this plenty of times, right? Which is, you must be doing some kind of high-tech work, right? And mm-hmm. then all of that kind of cliched stuff, right? And I think, but your point, Arjun, about this moment, right, which is like, are we hitting a shift in a moment? That's, I'm kind of, I'm interested in that.
It feels like, and I guess, you know, that Asian Americans are now starting to speak out.
Yeah.
And not just go along with it. But speak out and say, like, you know, I mean, there was that whole article in the New York Times, Asian Americans are no longer happy, like with whitewashing, and they're going to speak out.
Yeah.
And that was something that was like, I don't know. And then in reading literature where people are writing about little explosions, it feels like it's something that's bubbling. Right. I mean, I think that it's something that, we talk about a lot. I mean, I was so excited in Nurse Jackie that I was one a nurse, not a doctor.
Yeah.
And that I was bad at my job.
Yeah.
Like, that was really exciting to me because I wanted to, like, whether I was using that language or not, and I wasn't at that time, but I wanted to break down this idea of the model minority.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? For me, it was just I wanted to fragment the five images that I thought were for the South Asian male because I thought I wanted to have it be more expansive. But I don't know. It's just that was exciting to be like, oh, shit, okay, before 65 was exclusion, and now it's like, how do we be fully included? And maybe it's the pendulum now. Maybe we're trying to find balance. I don't know.
I will say, though, you know, that it isn't like there's voice now and there's voice absent before. Like, the voice is absolutely there, right? Like, you know, there are Asian American Studies departments because people were like, we need this, right? Right. There is a long history of that, right? That I teach books published in the 40s and 50s, right? Who are saying this is not working in the way that it should, right? That we are excluded out of American life. Of course, those books, you know, just didn't sell very well then. Right. It's because no one was, I think, interested in them, or it was not telling a story they wanted to be told. But your nurse thing is, it is amazing, right? Like, I mean, in some ways you can think like the most incredible books or some really remarkable books being published right now are by Indian male doctors, right? Which is this, you know, Abraham Verghese, who's a novelist. This guy, Siddhartha Mukherjee, who wrote this book about cancer.
And he wrote this book about the genes.
Ken Burns did a whole cancer thing, right? Yeah. And it is interesting what you're saying, which is, how is it that, like, in your own particular private moment when you're occupying this nurse and the life of this nurse, you can be like, okay, this is how you guys, how I am narrated, and this is how I'm going to screw with this in different kinds of ways.
Yeah. I mean, it was just really exciting
to do that.
Let's talk. Did you want to go back to the book for a second?
There's one real quick question. Yeah. In the lecture, you brought up a writer, Tomine, right? Is that how you said it?
Yeah, I think it's Adrian. They pronounce, I think it's Tomine or Tomine.
Tomine.
Yeah.
He had a quote. He said something about finding the dark, mundane details strangely uplifting.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking that moment, I thought about your book, and I was just wondering if that quote applied to you.
Oh, I mean, that's a thing, right? Like, I am transparent that I like the things that I teach because they speak so much to me. I am, right? Like, I think, here's the thing about those dark, quiet moments, right? Which is that moment at the end of housewarming,
right?
And it's not light, right? They're not happy.
It was actually depressing for me to read.
Hell yeah. But the point is, what I'm interested there is not happiness, but actually that Rohith has just learned a sliver of something he didn't know before, right? And that for me is the uplifting part, right? Which is, you know, I don't know where I was reading something about, like, I'm less interested in happiness for my characters and much more interested in them knowing something about themselves that they didn't know before.
And that's what you find uplifting.
That's what I find uplifting, is because there's a road then, right? The upliftment is that there is some new place to go once you've figured something out about yourself, right? Which is, if you, you know, I mean, I think it was you. The difference between pleasure and
happiness. This
pleasure and happiness.
Research. This guy did his research.
And so, but it's an interesting distinction, correct? Right. Like, I think you were suggesting that pleasure is short term, happiness is long term.
Yeah, and I think so, chasing pleasure usually decreases happiness.
So, but maybe my suggestion is that happiness is short term, knowledge is long term. I don't know. That's just, I just want to keep going with that flow. I just
threw
that
there.
This
is why we like to talk to professors.
Exactly. So that's, I think, part of it.
Okay, so I'm going to transition back to another aspect that we're going to go to the sports for a second. You talked about sports. You're talking about, now in class, there was an interesting part that you were talking about with Linsanity.
Yeah.
And you were talking about how Lin gave you, there was a quote, and I didn't copy it down because I wasn't taking notes that carefully. Yeah. But there was a paragraph about, at the end it said, like, what Linsanity allowed people to think about themselves.
Yeah.
Right? So now I'm going to place you as the student in the class.
Mm-hmm.
What did Lin make you think about yourself? I feel good about that question.
That's good.
You got him.
Before I got into Lin, right, I loved Vijay Singh, right?
Oh, Fiji Golf. Fijian golfer, right?
Right.
I should say Fiji Golf like that.
And the thing is, at a very basic level, I've been in when I lived in India until I was 8, I was a huge cricket fan.
Oh, yeah.
When I arrived here in the 80s, my mother and I, strangely enough, watched all those Lakers-Celtics games.
Oh, word.
I loved, we would watch tennis together. We loved, you know, French Open and Wimbledon. I have always been a huge sports fan. So if I grew up until I was 8 with, you know, Kapil Dev and Sunil Gavaskar, right? These great figures of, like, Indian sport, right? 15 years pass in this country when I'm at the height of my sports fandom, and I'm still huge, right? I waste way too much of my time watching and following sports.
It's not wasting at all.
And it's praying. But Vijay shows up and I'm like, wow, like, look at this, right? And I love Tiger, but even more than Tiger, Vijay was like, there's a very clear relationship, right? Which is, look, there's a dude that looks like me doing what, unfortunately, I'll never be able to do, but I'm happy for him to be that representative, right? Now, fandom is complicated. Like, why do we like the things that we like? We like them for whatever, you know, that it's close to your home, that, you know, it's you're a fan because you live in Oakland, you love the Warriors, or you hate this player, and that's why you hate this thing. All that stuff is complicated. So the thing was important, and then I have been an NBA fan for a long time, and of course, what's his name? Yao Ming had shown up before, right? But Lin was like, he was that story, right? I lived in Palo Alto between 1995 and 2001. And so, in 2002, sorry. And so, like, I know where he went to high school. I know.
But like, also that, like, Yao Ming was 7'6". Exactly. You expected him to be. Like, that's not stunning.
Yeah, it wasn't exciting.
Jeremy Lin, well, it could be. But he was, Yao actually had a pretty sweet game. But yeah. He was 7'6", kind of like, of course you're doing this.
And it's,
Jeremy Lin, like, where did the, he's like,
and it's,
where
I think, the same reason why we like Curry so much, right? Is because there's something he doesn't. LeBron is.
Klay Thompson just made this exact same point. Not everybody can relate to being 6'8", 260 pounds.
And there's this whole thing about like why Nike didn't sign Curry, right? And basically Nike was saying, we like our athletes are big, muscular alpha males, right? And so Jordan, Tiger, Rory, you know, LeBron, all these guys, right? But Curry is just a different thing. And Lin, I think, was that, right? And Lin was like, you know, for us, that story, which is, you know, he went to Harvard and he's doing this, right?
My Indian friends talked about that all the time.
Of course, right? It's because he is our, and I think the phrase I used there was that he was the model minority.
Yeah, that was
which
a great
is on
time.
One hand, you'd be like, you know, honestly, you're like, fuck you, man. Like, you can't do all this and be this good at this, right? But of course, it's not even envy. It's like this remarkable kind of, you know, thrill that this guy is doing it and that he was doing it in the way that he did it in the middle of New York City, right?
I was in New York for it. It was crazy. Oh, you could feel the buzz.
It was crazy.
There's something in one of these articles that we read, the guy, you know, they were saying that the number of articles that came out about the guy was just ridiculous. It's because people loved it, you know? And so I think that's why for me, purely as a guy watching way too much television, that's what it was, right? It was just like this. Finally, this opportunity.
What did it make you like? What did you learn something about yourself through that? Did it make you think about yourself differently in the community? Yeah. Did it make, because that seemed like that was part of the quote that the paragraph was saying?
Yeah,
I like that you didn't let him slide.
Nah, man.
What'd you say?
I like that he didn't let you slide on that.
That's the follow up question.
Yeah.
It's been like half an hour. There's not been a single follow up question. You know, I wonder, it's the difference between, if I'm being completely honest, there's a way in which Vijay felt like optically he looked like he was an Indian guy, right? I mean, of course, his family had migrated from India years before, right? In the 19th century. But there's a way in which I think I felt close to Lin in all these different ways that I talked about, but I didn't feel quite as close in the way that I felt with Vijay, right? And it doesn't mean, you know, it doesn't
no,
mean...
No, there's no judgment.
It just means that it is just what it is, right?
I'll tell you, I did not... Jeremy Lin meant nothing to me.
Yeah.
Meant nothing to
Lin
me.
Lin meant more to me than Vijay Singh.
Vijay Singh also, Tiger actually was more who I related to than Vijay.
Yeah.
And I think because Tiger had a swag that I felt like that I was more resonant with.
Totally.
That just, you know what I mean, to be completely honest with you. But it's interesting because Lin was not, and I think, I'll be honest, how religious he was.
Yeah.
Was the thing that I was like, I don't know how to relate into this.
No, and that's the thing is, I think, I don't know who's the guy he was playing, is not but you know, they do
Wilson
that.
Wilson Chandler.
They do this thing where they when they hit a big shot, they'd like be pretending to read the Bible, right? And when first started seeing that, I was like, oh, this might not be, I mean, but that's just a part of him that did not resonate with me, right?
Right.
And that's why there, you know, what I tried to do in the class was just to say, look, there are just so many layers of this. Right. There are versions of this layer that you could really engage with, right? And I think that's what you were saying, right? That Tiger became this, you know, kid from like Cypress, California, right? Like from this, you know, LA suburb who did it, and he had this kind of swagger that you liked. You know, VJ's swagger was like not of that same type.
But VJ was very like classic, old school, very like calm. That's what I remember.
And also, like, I will say nothing, right? Like when people tried to interview him, he'd be like, nope, nothing, you know? And I don't know, I kind of appreciated that.
I love that.
And
let me ask you this.
Yes.
You, the class, the lecture we were in, and it seems like this interview, you look at culture through the lens of sport a lot.
Yeah.
Why is it?
I think it's because for a long time, it's one of those things that we think of as being pure entertainment, right? And I think, you know, wait, think about this, right? Which is how many people click on to ESPN.com every single day?
Three in this room.
Three, but, you know, three plus whatever, you know, 20 million unique hits, which is probably... like I'm lowballing it, right? Meaning that there are so many narratives about race and gender and all this stuff that is being played out, right? Which is, you know, when, you know, there's stories that are constructed. You know, it's not just the game. They're trying to figure out, like, it's this against this, the Yankees versus the Red Sox, right? So you create stories. And what I'm just trying to figure out is what those stories are.
But here's where
I was really interesting for me about the symbols that we attach to this sport. I mean, it becomes how we, what narratives, what is the cultural landscape? But like for the Yankees, I used to, my parents, when they emigrated, they lived in the Albany, and the Yankees were the team. They went to several Yankees. So I was born and raised, like, I was kind of indoctrinated in some ways with the Yankees.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, so I hated the Red Sox. But then I remember, like, I started to learn about the culture of the Yankees and, like, how it was incredible, like, so corporate. Everyone had to be clean-shaven. There's no
thing. Pinstripes, baby.
And then the Red Sox were, like, the lovable idiots, like, right? And I was like, well, I kind of like that more. And it was weird because, like, I start all of a sudden this huge conflict in my head was like, well, I feel like I actually, as a human, am more related to this, but I have to hate them.
Of course.
It's just these, like, sports becomes this amazing place for us to see who we are. It, like, reflects back at us. But that's what I'm hearing from you.
Here's my question, though. There is so rarely an Asian American reflection in American sport, and then you seem to tie the two together a lot. And I'm not, like, questioning it like venomous or anything. I'm genuinely curious, how did that connection happen for you? Where it's like you, Vijay Singh was 15 years ago. Then Lin Sanity wasn't even us, South Asian. That was Asians we don't necessarily identify with. And we're still like, all right, a lot of South Asians are like, all right, him. That's as close as we're getting.
Yeah.
So.
But I mean, the one thing I want to make clear is that my interest in sports is not just in terms of Asian Americans, right?
No, I understand.
It is all of it, right? Like there's a way in which, like, why did I like Tim Duncan, right? Like possibly, you know, the greatest, most boring player ever.
Not
right?
boring.
Am
at
I?
All.
What's that?
Not boring at all.
No, exactly. And so,
what Akash is asking though is why in a class about Asian American studies is sports one of the main? Why has that become the vehicle through which you explore?
That's what I'm trying to
Good. It is a vehicle. So we did kind of literature. We did film, we did novels, we did short stories, and sport was one of them. And what I wanted to do was I wanted to say, look, we can talk about sports for these 2 weeks, and then we're going to move on to this great novel. Mm. And that the way in which we talk about a novel is we can use that same language to talk about sports. It was not just all. Okay. I mean, I think I could easily do 10 weeks on sports. It would be a fun thing for me to do. But it was just one. Yes. So I didn't get the question. So, it was just one vehicle that I used. A vehicle that I feel particularly. And I also think that, you know, a lot of the students are deeply engaged in it. And so I think that they're suddenly like, you know, I'm talking about. I mean, it's so funny you brought up Emerson and Thoreau. Like, literally, in the beginning of class, I did this whole Emerson and Thoreau thing in relationship to India. And, and then, of course, like, Arjun just, like, randomly brings up Emerson and Thoreau. When I was talking about Emerson and Thoreau, they're like, yeah, whatever. I have no idea what the difference is. But if I suddenly bring up Tiger,
I'm in there.
Right. If I bring up kind of, you know, there's so much to say about it. There's so much to say about it. I mean, there's a piece today in The Undefeated, which is a new ESPN thing about kind of why, kind of what it means for Curry to be so light skinned and why that kind of shapes the way in which we have kind of engaged with him. So there's a shit ton, a lot of stuff to say about a lot of this stuff.
I'd love to shift away from the teaching of your class to just actually the makeup. You've been teaching Asian American Studies for, you said you've been at UCSB for five?
Yeah, no, since 2007.
So that's 9 years.
Yeah, long time.
Oh, wow. Have you been teaching Asian American Studies the entire time?
Yeah, I have. So my first job was in an English department.
Okay.
So I got a PhD in this program, which is kind of a literature program. And then I went off to teach, I was hired to teach South Asian literature. So stuff published in India, out of India, and kind of what they call post-colonial literature, which is kind of the literatures of the British Empire, right? And kind of meaning kind of not just India and Pakistan, but also South Africa and the Caribbean and all the different literatures that was produced in kind of in the colonial and the post-colonial context. And then here, I came into a very different kind of department. And a lot of what happens in academic life is where you are physically placed, meaning what department you're in, changes the kinds of things that you're talking about, right? And so when I taught in the English department, you know, there are debates about like the romantics and like how should we hire a medievalist? That's not the debate that's going on here, right? And in some ways I felt very, I loved the people there and I loved the job, but there were debates that were not kind of keeping me up at night.
Right.
Conversations here are things that I like, that I'm engaged in, that are about me and about the students that I teach and all of
this
other stuff.
They also feel more direct, like more tangibly affecting your one. But I wanted to get back. The question I had about the class has to do with the makeup of the students. I'm always fascinated when we walk into classrooms, especially Asian American Studies. Who are the kids that you've seen are taking this class and why? Can you speak to that over... This class seemed really diverse, and it felt like there was a wide variety, but mainly Asian Americans in the classroom.
Yeah, no, so the thing is, this is, that class is general education class, so, you know, the way it's set up is, you know, this one fulfills, like, I think an ethnicity requirement. So that's why I get people...
An ethnicity requirement? Is that a real thing?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And so it's...
California, baby.
It's California. And so I think it fulfills an ethnicity requirement, and maybe... an arts or one of those, you know. And so part of the reason why it's packed is students need to do it, right?
Right.
I take that seriously in the sense, like, if this is one or two classes that some of my students are going to get where they're critically engaged with race and ethnicity, like, that's a lot, you know, it's a lot to manage. And I try to do it as best as I can. You know, and I do get, I mean, the Asian American students, you know, I had a student come up to me last week and say, you know, thank you, mainly because she's like, you know, it was good to confirm these feelings that I have had where I feel excluded in particular ways. I don't have the critical language to say this is why it's happening.
Right.
And what a class like this does is it says there is a long history of this. You're not some lone person feeling it by yourself in your room. Right, that there's a larger thing going on, and this is the way in which it's happening, right? And so I think you're right today. I mean, the class is completely diverse. There are all sorts. I mean, this, and part of this just has to do with California and Santa, you know, UCSB, the UC system, right? Which is, it does a lovely job of bringing in a remarkable group of students.
Yeah, completely and diverse. Zero black people. I'm going to point that out real quick. But
no, that's not true.
I
saw one or two if I did.
Yeah.
And I can't definitively
say. That might just be the school.
Yeah. No, I mean, the funny thing is when I taught at Queens was, it was in some ways exactly like this, but way more South Asians, right?
Yeah.
Way more like students, like recent South Asian arrival students, right? Not us who've been here, you know, both of you were born here. I came here when I was young. And so all of these places, and so much of it, I mean, I think that's what you're saying about, like, what dictates your teaching. Part of it's your students, right? Like, what is it that the students are demanding? What is it that you are trying to, like, undo for the students, right? Which is, what are the ideas they have that you're trying to mess with?
What do you think? Is there a big theme that you feel like you want to address with them every time? Is there like a big thing that you're like, I always have to get them to think this way, yeah, or I have to untrain this,
yeah,
habitual pattern of thinking? Is there one thing you can identify, or is that not a fair question?
No, I mean, it's a fair question. I don't know if I do it explicitly, okay, but there's something you said in class today, which is when you were saying, look, there are all these stereotypical roles that I take that are out there, but I will sometimes engage with them because the least I can do is figure out how to humanize them, right? Mm-hmm. And so that I can give them, where if the stereotype just makes them flat, right, that they just do, like, they do what these people are supposed to do, what you're able to do is to say, look, there's a whole host of stuff going on, and I'm going to try to kind of bring that stuff out, right? I may not do this explicitly, but what I'm always trying to figure out how to do is to give them a sense that Asian American literature or Asian American popular culture, that there is so much complexity that is going on here, that usually we don't, like, there are ways in which with these stereotypes, the complexity is totally removed, right? And Big Bang Theory is probably like ground zero for that, right? And so what I'm trying, and yeah, it's the most popular show on CBS, right? Like, CBS is making a mint off of it.
And let's make it very clear, that's not, I don't mean to say, and I don't know if you'd agree with this or not, but I don't mean to say that Big Bang Theory is wrong because they do that. My issue is just that that's the only place we have.
Exactly. I mean, all you're looking for, and I think this is what you're suggesting, is I would like 10 voices.
Right.
And if there are 10 voices, that means there is no South Asian dude. There is no Asian American one person, right? And I think that that's what all of this is about, which is to say that there are these, like, different ideas being constantly produced. And I think that that's, to circle back to the fiction a little bit, part of what I was trying to do is to say, look, my experience has been different, but I don't think that that difference means it's, like, only me, right? Like, I was trying to get to these characters to say, look, that there is all sorts of stuff going on here. There are these different kinds of lives. The epigraph for the book is, I love this guy, John Cheever, and it's an epigraph, you know, yeah. Cheever was writing in the 50s about, like, suburban male crisis, right? What does that have to do with suburban Indian male crisis? Turns out a whole lot.
This is what Arjun always says, and this is actually something that struck me through the book, is a lot of these stories, they're specific to, it's happening to South Asians, but it's something that resonates with anybody, any race within this lifestyle. Arjun always says, through the specific, we see the universal.
Totally. No, that's, he's stealing my line, you know? But that is it, right? You do it in enough detail, and you're totally true to the detail, right? You do not whitewash it. You guys, we observe our parents, we observe our siblings, right? And that's, if you're kind of working, if you're writing or acting, you're trying to take some of that stuff and be true to it. But I do think, ultimately, if you're really, really true to it, then, you know, a whole lot of people will experience it.
It's true, because at the end, I'm going to say it, but the more specific, all we're talking about at the end of the day are feelings of loss or betrayal or desire to be connected.
Yeah.
When we're writing about humans, even whatever culture it is, if we're getting to the truth of it, we're really just talking about humanity, and we're talking about the human experience dressed up in different forms. And I think that what happens is that when we limit people's images, we make them caricatures and they're no longer human. That's and right. I think that when we fragment it and give them a three dimension, they get to be elevated to the level of humanity rather than something that's not. And I think that that's why, I mean, Akash and I get into this argument all the time about how many of us should be represented based, you know, for Akash, and I'm going to represent it in my best way. It's about, well, we don't have that. We're not a sizable part of the population. So why would we be overrepresented with, like, so many people on in media?
Yeah.
And for me, it's like, well, imagistically, I'm human, therefore I'm expansive. If we're going to represent what it means to be one type of people, we need a ton of images in order to do that, so that we can't be just cartoons or caricatures, but to be human.
Yeah. And I mean, and I'm just, this is a little off the cuff, but to that point, right, about population versus the number, right? Part of, I think, what we're talking about is it's not as if we are just representing Indianness or South Asianness, right? Like, the larger argument here is that Indianness and South Asianness can represent a whole range of other things, right?
Yeah.
So it doesn't need to be just that you have an Indian dude on a show that he is the Indian dude, right?
Right.
That the idea is that he is an Indian dude who represents Indianness, but there's a whole host of other things on those things, right? On love and vanity and pride and all this stuff, the human emotions that shape us. And I think the question that you guys are asking, that I'm constantly asking, is like, why can't other people get to articulate those ideas, right? Like, why can't you represent that kind of idea? Like, why can't you be that voice for it? And the more voices there are, the more kind of normalized it becomes, right?
Well, what I'm hopeful for is I think that people have a thirst for this now. I think people are thirsty to know about other cultures. I think that that's becoming more, and hopefully that will allow for change, so that, you know, people that are in power and scared can start to feel more comfortable that, hey, you know what, if we put out a story, if we're like, we publish a book, that there will be an audience outside of a niche market.
Yeah.
And I'm hopeful that shifts. I really am. We're running out of time. You want, ask, no, yeah, of course.
One last question from me. You're a college professor. You see college kids every year. There's something I've been saying for a long time, but it's starting to enter, like, I guess, the mainstream zeitgeist, that college kids are too sensitive.
Yeah.
What's your perspective of the college kids that come and take your class?
Yeah, you know, the thing is, I mean, I always say this, like, I'm envious of these kids, right? Like, when they sit there, I'm envious that they are younger than me.
Right.
I'm envious that they have way more brain cells than me. I'm envious that they have the choices that they have, right? Which is, I think that there's a way in which, you know, I think part of it is the same way that we talk about, like, not saying this is what Indianness is like. I think I'm not comfortable saying this is what college kids are like, right?
Right.
But there is, I mean, but they're certainly different than me, right? Like, they've grown up on social media, which makes them different people.
Are they different than when you started?
Yeah, so how has it morphed from when you
2007
started
2007 to
2016?
Or has it?
You know, I don't see some huge, sizable difference, right?
Fair.
I do think that there is, you know, there's this amazing Zadie Smith essay on where she does a review of The Social Network, the movie. Zuckerberg movie. And she begins the essay, this beautiful essay about, where she says that she keeps thinking that she is really different from her students, right? And what she ends up saying is that, in fact, that there's not actually just a difference. The main thing is that the software that's shaping their lives is not up to the task of who these kids are, right? Meaning that Facebook and Twitter and all of this stuff has, like, boiled them down to people that they are not, right?
Mm.
And the fact is, you look around campuses, like, there's stuff happening on campuses. They're not being passive, right? They're saying things that don't make them happy, that they're kind of engaged in things. And I'm thrilled for their engagement, right? Like, we can talk about how that engagement is different, but, you know,
I'll tell you one difference I noticed. You stopped talking for a second during your lecture, and I just heard, I couldn't tell what that sound was because I was sitting in the front row.
Totally.
And then I looked around, I was like, oh my God, this is just the sound of thousands of keys being typed at 1 second. It was really intense for me because even in my college experience, which was not that long ago, I graduated in 2007, but that wasn't the norm at all.
No, and the thing is, I'll tell you, like, I see this all the time when I'm standing up there. Like, PowerPoint is tyranny, you know? Like, meaning that I'll put a new slide up, and then they'll tune out.
Yeah.
And then I'll switch slides. But the point is, the good stuff comes between the slides, right? Meaning the things that I want to convey to them I get between what I've written, right? And that's a little bit of a bummer that in that middle time, they're not, the keys are not clicking, right?
Right.
And it's such a different experience. Like now students don't even take, or not even writing it down. What I change slides and I see phones go up. And they take pictures of my
brilliant
slides,
students,
right? Wow. And so, I mean, they know they're using the technology. I mean, it just cracks me up.
Not really effective.
Yes, but
that's fine.
It's
so quicker.
All
it's
of
convenient.
That stuff is very, very different. You know, I used to do this thing in college where I would take notes, and then I had another folder for the same class, and I would rewrite the notes.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. That's how you would memorize. That's how you would learn.
That's how you cut out all the weird stuff that you wrote. You figure out what's the right thing, like the things that you were supposed to engage in. Our notebooks are different.
Yeah.
In the years that have passed.
We have to sign off now, but we'll have to come back for part two. I feel like there's so much more that we haven't even gotten a chance to explore. For our listeners, The Blind Writer is out now.
It is, yeah.
5 stars on Amazon.
Get it. You better be rating that because you ain't rating us, but you better be rating that. they can find that on Amazon and in bookstores, I'm assuming,
yeah,
as well.
Everywhere. Amazon is, you know, Jeff Bezos has figured it out.
There you go.
And it is on Amazon, and it will, and so, and I think it's in the various, you can get it as Kindle or a physical book or whatever you like.
Is there other ways they can find out if they're interested in more of your writings or just to more news for you? Like,
yeah, I mean,
Twitter?
I have a website, my name, Sameer Pandya, SameerPandya.net. So everything I've written is on there. You know, links to the sports writing I've done,
awesome,
to the fiction I've published.
Amazing.
And then just, you know, and it's in orange. I like orange, so.
And any Twitter? Are you a Twitter guy at all? Or
yeah,
no?
I think my handle is @SameerPandya, but I just, to be honest, like I think way too much before I tweet, but maybe I'll tweet more.
you should follow the Akash.
I'm going to learn, man.
I'm going to tell you something. I remember the day I got to Akash's place, and I was just like, what are you doing? He was on the computer. I'm deleting tweets from 4 years ago. Yeah. You deleted how many? 4 years worth of tweets?
No, I tried. I couldn't do it.
Oh, God.
People are going to be horrified when I look back. And what I had to say.
No, but yeah, it's a difference, you know? And so, but I would like to do more of that. It would be, anyway. But listen, thank you for coming
you.
And hanging out.
The pleasure has been all ours. Thank you for kicking off our West Coast trip in such a beautiful way. This has been so fun. Guys, you know what we're about to say. Please keep rating our podcast. We're trying to build a community. We love to hear from you guys. So please reach out to us. Let us know what you're thinking about. We want to hear from you. We have more ratings than last time we talked to you.
We do, but
we'd love more because we vain.
5-star it. Stop wasting time. It's really easy to click 5 stars. We don't need your real opinions. I'm gonna be honest. I've heard a few of them. I'm not impressed. Your real opinions, who cares?
We should start doing bad cop before good cop, so that I can end with good cop.
Yeah, I know. We keep saying this,
and then I don't do it.
Yeah.
Anyway, next week we're gonna come back with another episode. It's gonna be amazing, obviously, because that's what we do. That's why we want that 5-star. Right. So come back at us next week. I'm Arjun.
I'm Akash.
And we'll catch you then.
God bless.